Morning, everyone. Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. A hybrid meeting from Theosophy Hall and on Zoom. We welcome you all to consider our ideas. They're not our ideas. We should say the philosophy of theosophy as put forth in writing in the latter part of the 19th century. So we have several activities a week, including this Friday. We're beginning this expression of the roundtable discussion, which starts at 6:30 and ends at 7:30. It's on Zoom only. So the emails will go out giving the exact citation. It's from a series of articles called In the Light of Theosophy. So that'll be October the 6th, Friday at 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. on Zoom. Now, on Sunday mornings, the doors open at 10:30 at Theosophy Hall. Our meeting begins at 11 and ends promptly at 12. So today we're going to be talking about the secret doctrine, its nature and its source. So the doors, as we said, open at 10:30. Now, on Wednesdays, we're beginning our new fall, winter, summer semester from October through the end of June. And it's the Ocean of Theosophy, Chapter One. Talking about the masters. And that is on Wednesday evening. The doors open at 6:15. The library opens at the same time. And the book table is available as well for your if you want to purchase straight line theosophical pamphlets and books.
Oh, yeah, there you go in the corner. But your video is off if
We
you
need to mute,
want to.
please. Straight line theosophical pamphlets and books at cost. There's no profit to be made because we consider this your birthright, really. So we make no profit whatsoever. We'd now like to read our declaration. So we're going to have two speakers today. The secret doctrine is nature and source, beginning with the source. So we have two speakers. But first, we would like to read, and of course, all of our activities are supported by voluntary free will contributions of time, money, and service. And all contributions are welcome, but there's nothing is imposed or implied. So we will now read our declaration, which is the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. It welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. And so, the secret doctrine, the magnum opus, as recorded by HPB, as she was affectionately known, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. She did not invent it, as she was adamant to say. She was the recorder of it. It was not a hallucination from her brain whatsoever. It's the accumulated wisdom of ages. It is not the entire secret doctrine, but that portion to which humanity is privileged to have at this point. And it's really the food for centuries, intellectually, spiritually speaking. So when we consider the phrase, the secret doctrine, it conjures up a sense of mystery and a desire to know. This is inherent in the human psyche. In today's world of instant information, good, bad, or indifferent, that the governments, corporations, and individuals want to either conceal or reveal as suits the motivations of the party or parties, we are all faced with a choice, at times a dilemma. Do I accept at face value this information? Do I ignore it, reject it, ridicule it, or react in some way? Theosophy teaches that thought is the real plane of action. Critical thinking, the ability to step back and consider what is being presented before we act, is a sign of a rational, reasonable adult, or even a healthy child for that matter. Information overload causes a fatigue, a stress, and confusion. It can cause that. We need to filter and sift out the coarse from the fine, as a sieve does. However, there are eternal truths, and there are knowers and guardians of these timeless truths. For we live and are governed by imperishable law. Law being an aspect of deity, just as evolution is an aspect of deity as well. Deity, law, and evolution is the trinity that creates, corrects, and coerces, not only our little system of worlds, but all worlds everywhere and at all times. For it is either a universe of law or a universe of chance. Man, capable of self-reflective thought, possessing free will, and able to plan and prosecute his plans, is what sets us apart from the other kingdoms, notably the lower kingdoms. We possess free will in every situation, no matter how limiting the circumstances. On this earth chain of globes, on which we are working out our slow and painful process of evolution, our minds were lit up by more advanced hierarchies in the scheme of evolution. Also, we were of one sex, or no sex, if you will, until a little over 18 million years ago, when came the separation of the sexes and also self-consciousness. Manas, which is the mind principle, which is distinct from brain, which the brain is an instrument of mind, became aware through self-reflective thought at that time. We mention this only to give a faint idea of the scope of the vastness of which we live. The eternal pilgrims, which are ourselves, it is said that man never was not. After infant humanity received instruction in arts, science, and all useful knowledge by the gods, for then the gods did walk the earth, they retreated to their place, perhaps to other spheres, but we have never been abandoned. We may feel alone, but mankind, again, has never been without a friend. Only so much is given out of the secret doctrine at any point in time, and sometimes it is withdrawn from the public at times when its perversion and or blind unthinking application would cause more harm than good. So these great teachers, these divine kings, masters of wisdom, perfected beings from prior periods of evolution, set this whole thing in motion. And then they don't abandon us, but it's up to us now to evolve and to grow and to learn and to suffer and to triumph as well. So great teachers appear in an orderly cycle in order to instruct man and provide an impulse to correct course. Krishna, Buddha, and Jesus were three of these fraternity. Jesus echoed Buddha and gave out no new teachings, but he actually came at a time of approaching spiritual darkness, and the esoteric teachings of the secret doctrine needed to be withdrawn from the public. It said he spoke in dark sayings and parables to the uninitiated. We are going to fast forward here past the times of ignorance and superstition to the year 1375. In a supreme act of compassion in that year, the adept Tsongkhapa enjoined the adepts to make an attempt to enlighten the world in the last quarter of every century. So he inaugurated inaugurated a cycle. He reformed Buddhism establish the Gelugpa order, or the Yellow Hats, and banish many thousands of sham monks from Tibet. We do not have time to survey all the attempts to enlighten the world in the last quarter of each succeeding century, but 500 years of regular periodic efforts bore fruit in 1875 when H.P. Blavatsky, primarily, since she is the direct agent of the adepts, and her co-worker, William Q. Judge, began public presentations and in print of a portion of the wisdom religion, the secret doctrine. We need to mention Colonel Olcott as well as an important worker and organizer who was president of the Theosophical Society. So we'll stop here and hear our second speaker at this time.
There we go. Friends, as we listen to this first presentation, an idea that becomes immediately apparent to us is that the secret doctrine in its broadest aspect refers to a spiritual knowledge impacted in the very spiritual center of a human being, and also in possession of a long line of both perfected human beings, those who have developed their faculties to the highest possible degree so that they could look into the very heart of nature. And it is from their accumulated efforts to discover, confirm, and preserve this knowledge that we have a body of knowledge, an ancient wisdom which synthesizes science, religion, and philosophy. And portions of it in the right cycle have been passed down, become portions of all the great philosophies and religions in the world. And so there have also been times when it's just been preserved among their disciples. And so we might say that's the broadest nature and scope of this term, the secret doctrine, which has corresponding names in different religious and philosophical traditions around the world. But in this presentation, we're going to be discussing the secret doctrine as it relates to a title of the major literary work of H.P. Blavatsky in the time in which she lived. So we want to begin with a brief statement of the history of this publication. Volume one of The Secret Doctrine was published in October 1888, and volume two was published the following January. The first edition was some 500 copies, which immediately sold out, and subsequent issues, publications became necessary. In fact, there has never been a time since then when it has been out of print. So there's been a continuous demand for this book up to this very day. And by inquiring and thoughtful individuals. Now, the subtitle is The Synthesis of Science, Religion, and Philosophy. And that gives us an idea of its nature, its scope. And when we think of science, religion, and philosophy, we think of them being separate. In fact, if you were to go to a university, there'd be different departments of science, different departments of religion, and different departments of philosophy. And even within those departments, there'd be tremendous specialization. And so we think of, and even their investigations and their theories are very often separate and come to different conclusions from one another. So when we're speaking of a synthesis, we're talking about a work that is going to include science, but not limited to just that which can be directly observed by our physical instruments and physical senses, but investigates the laws of all departments of nature, visible and invisible to our senses, so to speak. When we talk about it being a synthesis of religion, we're not going to talk about religion just from a point of view of ideas that we have to accept or have faith in or believe in, but rather something that could be checked, tested, and verified that has a scientific, lawful basis. And we talk about philosophy. We're talking about a basis of thought and action that is universal, self-proving, can be applied in any circumstance, and really represents the meaning of that word, a lover of truth, a lover of wisdom, something that we see the value of it, not just for its theoretical speculation, but its ability to answer the questions we have about ourselves, about life, and how to react in this world we live in. So this gives us an idea of the scope of the book. And it's interesting that she dedicates, these are her very works. She says, "This work I dedicate to all true theosophists in every country and of every race, for they called it forth, and for them it was recorded." And so what does she mean by a true theosophist? Well, she means that individual of whatever race or country or condition who has reached a point in their mind and heart where they feel themselves innately compelled to be of true service to humanity, not to a specific portion of humanity, although that may be necessary, or a specific race or a specific problem, but devoted to humanity as a whole, feeling their unity and responsibility to others, both our neighbor as well as humanity in general. And so they would need a body of knowledge that would help them do this, because we know that even good intentions and even good works, intended good works, without knowledge can very often lead to unanticipated difficulties and problems and obstacles. So we look at the structure of this book, The Secret Doctrine, and that gives us an idea of its nature and scope. You know, we look at buildings, and just from the structure of them, we can tell them whether it's a business, whether it's a bank, whether it's a place of worship, whether it's a where people live. Just from the structure of it, you can tell something of its nature, its scope. And so the first volume, as we said, that was published in October 1888, is entitled Cosmogenesis, and has to do with the origin and evolution of the universe. And we may immediately think to ourselves, what does that have to do with my being better able to help humanity? Why is it necessary for me to even consider how this universe came into being? And that might be something we might talk about in our discussion section today. But this section describes the rebirth of worlds after their period of rest, periodic rest, and how a particular globe and its lower kingdoms evolve up to the time of the human form is developed. Now, the second volume is called Anthropogenesis. And once again, we might think, well, what practical value does it know for me to know how humanity came into existence, or how it initially evolved? What does that have to do with the problems that I deal with in the world today? And so we see there is a further discussion of the evolution of the human form, of the awakening or lighting up of mind by the incarnation of human souls from prior worlds, the subsequent evolution of the early races up to the present period, and the future development projected for humanity if the original grand design is carried out. At each one of these volumes, cosmogenesis and anthropogenesis is further subdivided into three parts. And this also gives us an idea of its scope and nature. And the first part of each volume deals with what are called the stanzas of Zahn and their commentaries. And the idea here is the stanzas of Zahn represent a book, the recording of this ancient wisdom that had been checked, tested, verified, and accumulated down through the ages by the adepts, and remains, as it was said, the birthright of humanity, preserved for humanity, at which time portions of it are given out. And so some of these stanzas are given out in relationship to the origin of the universe and the origin of the anthropogenesis of the humanity and its races and nations. And then the second part of each volume has to do with the evolution of symbolism. And when we think of symbolism, well, language is a symbol. We think of all different kinds of symbols. Language is a means by which we convey and preserve. Symbols are a means by which we convey and preserve information, knowledge. And if we study these symbols, we can see that this knowledge was always present, preserved in the symbols around the world, and at different times given out. And as we see its evolution, we can see that the very understanding of humanity, the application of these ideas, has changed through the years, through the centuries, through the eras, but always it's been the same knowledge preserved in these symbols. And then the third part of each section has to do with science and the secret doctrine contrasted. The science of our modern civilization, which tends to be materialistic in its scope and its nature and its source, meaning that where it draws its conclusions from, its information from, is the information provided to the physical senses and the extension of our physical senses in the way we do our research. Comparing that with the science, the laws of this accumulated wisdom. Now, what about the source of the secret doctrine? Well, in one sense, we could say that the source is the author, H.P. Blavatsky. But she has said, and she says it in the book, that she is not a revealer of mystic lore made public for the first time in the world's history. And we'll see why that is the case. She also said she didn't invent anything, but was simply given out which had been known before and was taught to her. And also that it's not her personal speculation or theory. So in what sense is she the author? And she says she's the author in the sense that she gathered together from the oldest tenets and made them of one harmonious whole. So in a sense, she is the author because she gathered from all these different sources and put them into a consistent, organized presentation, which could be understood by the contemporary and modern thinkers. You know, so in that sense, she's the author. But she said she was taught, everything she expressed there, she was taught by more advanced students, the adepts, the individuals who have checked, tested, and verified these ideas, and that they still live and work in our modern times and periodically have their agents that express these ideas in the world. And the other source we mentioned was the stanzas of the Book of Zahn, the actual recorded information that's been preserved down through the ages. And its source, we might also say, is the accumulated knowledge of nature, of the hidden laws of nature that we don't necessarily know with our physical senses, but we know that are there. If somebody wanted to know of our nature, we could look at each other in a classroom or maybe see each other on a computer, but we know what we see with our eyes or hear with our ears is only the tip of the iceberg of their nature, that there's a lot to human nature which we don't know or we don't see and yet is real. And it's the same with the nature around us. So the source of what is said in the secret doctrine has a lot to do with that hidden nature. So what do we find as we open the secret doctrine? And it's not easy. It's a challenge because we don't find necessarily a clear exposition from beginning to end. We find within it, yes, certain definite statements of general principles, but we found mixed in with it the contents scattered throughout of thousands of volumes embodying scriptures of the great Eastern and European religions hidden under glyphs and symbols. So we'll find references to these same ideas expressed in all different philosophies and religions. And it's sort of like going to a university after you've read through or studied the secret doctrine. It's like getting a master's or a PhD in philosophy, religion, science, archaeology, anthropology. But it's more than that, because once again, you don't get the education of how they're different, but how they all link together into one unified whole. Oh, so we find in that book, if we read it, a comparison of several dozens philosophies and over half a dozen world religions. So this is not light reading. It's for those who seriously feel that they want to know. It's for those who call it forth. For them, it was recorded. So, and also we get to realize that for everything that it's there, it's not the secret doctrine in its entirety. It's not the entire accumulated wisdom of the ages, but a select number of its fragments. We might say it's the first installment, Theosophy 101, that we have to go through and master to our degree before we can go to the next stage of understanding. And as we read it and study it and apply it, we develop in ourselves the capacity to learn and appreciate the next stage, just like in any grade in school. And we also find within there the fundamental doctrine and teachings. And we might say that if this work is going to be of benefit to humanity, if it's written for those who feel themselves that they want to make themselves better able to help and serve humanity, to be of true service to humanity, it has to give them a basis for thought and action based on universal ideas, based on ideas that are self-proving and that have application to better understanding of oneself and others. And this is all incorporated in the very beginning of the secret doctrine in one of the introductory sections called the Prome. And we have there expressed the three fundamental propositions upon which the entire work is based. So important are they that every other of our Wednesday meetings, where we talk about the philosophy, we begin with a summary of those three fundamental propositions. And it is important for anyone who really wants to understand theosophy, maybe not all its little intricacies, but understand it enough to be able to take it and carry it with them and use it in their lives, that they have their own way of understanding, expressing, and applying these three ideas. So these ideas are going to come up all the time. And we might say that's one of the unique features of the secret doctrine, that it gives us this compact way of carrying the entire body of wisdom with us with a few basic ideas. And of course, we can see many ramifications of it, but it gives us that. So what is its purpose? And we'll end with these few ideas. Why was the book written? Why was it felt that it was important to give out to those who want to be better able to be of true service to humanity? Well, the first thing she tells us is the basic and fundamental principles of every exoteric religion and philosophy, old or new, were from first to last echoes of a primeval wisdom religion, but they had become disfigured over time, as things have a tendency to do. Buildings decay, our bodies decay, even a body of knowledge that's expressed can decay, become disfigured over time, and different from its original presentation. And so she wanted to show that all the different religions and philosophies, even though they seem to have changed over time, you can look within them, you can look at their original sources and see that they are all contained and were expressing the same truths. And this was part of this body of knowledge. They all came from the same mother, from the same source, from the same ocean of knowledge. So how do we treat human beings who have ideas that we realize were from the same source as those we believe in? We treat them like we would treat anything that comes from the same mother or the same source. We treat them as brothers and sisters, the son and daughters of one source of knowledge and wisdom. So we learn to look beyond the differences of ideas and opinions and begin to see and identify and work with the fundamental universal truths that are behind all of them. So the other thing, in terms of science, it's important for understand that this universe of atoms and forces is not by chance. It is not fortuitously thrown together without any design or purpose or meaning to us. And also that there, and what no matter, and science is acknowledged to achieve great understanding, but the inner departments of nature are still a great mystery to us and have not been explored as they should, because science has built a wall around its investigation. So far it will go and not any further. And so if we want to understand the full nature of those we live with in our world, we have to break down that wall. And we can't just depend on science for us. It assigns to us, to mankind, our rightful place in the scheme of the universe. And when it says mankind, humanity, it's referring to both sexes, and it's referring to us as individuals. It assigns to you your right place in the universe. And think of it. What do we hold as our place in the universe? From what science has taught us, from what religion has taught us, from what our society has taught us. What do we carry around thinking about ourselves as where we fit in the scheme of things? And so this secret doctrine was to break down those limitations and ideas about what we think we are and begin to have us understand of what we are and what we further could be. As we said, it demonstrates the truths that are the basis of all religions and demonstrates the fundamental unity from which they all sprung, the fundamental unity of religion, of philosophy, of science, and humanity as well. And when you think about that, this knowledge of a truer realization of the self, the unity of all, the unity of nature, is essential if we are going to begin to work and improve the world we live in with all its differences of opinions and ideas of separateness and struggles. We need to understand what is the cause of that separateness and what is the remedy for it. So we'll stop here and open it up for your questions and comments on the secret doctrine, either in terms of the book or the grand body of knowledge from which it is only a small expression of. Yasvi Holt.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, if you could encapsulate, and you said that there are these three primary ideas, I know you've explained them. Would it be possible to just encapsulate sort of in a kind of top line what those three sort of primary ideas are?
Yes, we'll do it in three words. Deity, law, and evolution. Deity is the source of all. Law is how it all works. Evolution refers to the process or the why, the becoming of everything that is. Deity says that that source is infinite, cannot be limited either in its form or by the ideas we hold. But like space, it is everywhere in everything, is the source of all, it encompasses all, and has no limitations. Law, cause and effect, cycles. There is no miracle or chance, but everything operates under law. Of course, we may not understand that law and attribute it to miracle or chance, but the more we know of ourselves and nature, we see that law operates. And evolution is not just a physical change and development of form, but it's an evolution of mind, our ability to think and understand, and it's an evolution spiritually of ourselves as beings, working through long periods of evolution, a long series of different bodies and personalities, perfecting our abilities up to the highest possible degree, raising matter and substance up to the highest possible degree for the purposes of evolution, of improving ourselves and the world we live in. And there's no beginning or end to that process. So, of course, we imagine there's other ways of expressing it, but the point is that we each have to learn to carry it around for ourselves in a nutshell.
Great, thank you.
Yes, these ideas are huge, but they're kind of simple in a way. The basic concepts, they're just not materialistic. And we're so used to our world is highly materialistic, and it's very spiritual. Beginning with deity, deity is not a being. It's not a supreme being, because being implies limitation. A being is transitory. It comes, it goes, it's a vehicle. So we like the concept of be-ness. It is. We can just say about deity, it is. And it has, we can't ascribe qualities, really. We can just say that it is. We had a chat about the Big Bang Theory. Is that in the Secret Doctrine? Well, it's the doctrine of emanations. As far as a Big Bang, like boom, everything all at once, here it is. That was actually when it first came out, it was laughed at. And Big Bang was considered a pejorative. It was considered like insulting to the mind. But however, it's been adopted and it's been enshrined. And so it's much more than that, because it's not just blind matter. And it's just spirit and matter are co-equal. Spirit is the first differentiation of and in space, and matter is the first differentiation of spirit, and they're co-eternal. So there was a hand. Yes, in the back here.
Could we not see the disfiguration of the wisdom religion as a cultural adaptation? And we see the value in zooming out and seeing similarities, but is there also value to learning these kind of core teaching stories through our cultural, our own cultural lens?
So can we look at these teachings through our cultural lens? And yes, I mean, yeah, we would say so. We hope so. That's what we're trying to do here. We think, is there more to that? Or is there, the beginning of it was like, was it, in other words, what was the first part? I'm sorry.
You refer to kind of religious, like the different religions having the same.
Religions are an invention of man, is really what they are. And it's an attempt to describe our world, our universe, our thoughts, our feelings, our interactions, our motivations. It's, and some religions do a better job than others, but they end up being codified, and then people are splitting hairs and splitting heads over the differences of religion, and their inventions in the back.
Well, part of that contribution or question was, could it be said that different cultures or religions are they a disfiguration of the secret doctrine? And if secret doctrine is the source of all religions, then by definition, to the degree that any religion differs from the secret doctrine, that makes sense. It's a disfiguration. However, that's not to say that there's not a purpose to the culture and the religion into which a person is born. We are born into different communities and cultures for a purpose, because that's what fits our nature best in the world at the time, to provide opportunities to spiritually grow. So the issue here is there is unity and diversity. Let's not forget that. But it is imperative that we recognize unity first, and that's the one. The diversity is just the infinite differentiation of the unity, but the deep thinkers of all cultures understand the value of learning about all cultures. And so to break it down, unfortunately, in today's day and age, diversity is worshiped as the truth, when actually diversity, without first recognizing unity, it's not diversity, it's separatism. So the teaching needs to be first, we are one. And from that is all the beautiful array of music in an orchestra playing harmoniously for the purpose that the music is there for. Without recognizing the common chord or the common note upon which the orchestra is based, it's just a bunch of horns blowing their own thing, and it's chaos and it's dangerous in real life.
SL, do you have a contribution?
Yes. So here's what happens very often when one tries to read the secret doctrine or attempts it, is that they realize that the religion that they grew up in is not unique in its fundamental truths and expressions of the reality of life. What is different is the language which it's expressed, the symbols and rituals that grew up around those ideas. What is different is the various forces, some of which are cultural, but not all of them. Some are just due to human frailty that have grown up. But mostly what we learn about is how much our religion is like other religions, not only in its details, but it's in its fundamental unity. And so we get a deeper appreciation of our own religion because we realize that it's not just based on faith or belief, but it's based on fundamental truths and laws of nature. And there's much more to our religion than we expected. But at the same time, we gain a greater respect and understanding of the different religions around us. It's so we like bright white light, but how beautiful are the different colors that radiate from it? The solar spectrum, the reds, the yellows, the blues, the different hues, they're all valuable and beautiful and add color to our lives, but each one individually is not the whole. You have to put them all together to appreciate their unity and the source from which they come. And that's what theosophy or the secret doctrine teaches us to do.
Yes. So there was once one world religion, and everyone knew it. And there's evidence of this all over the world through archaeology. JB, you had your hand up.
Thank you. I had a question about the work itself. It seems like the stanzas of Zahn are kind of a backbone or starting point for both the volumes of the secret doctrine. And there's also words or writings that HPB got a lot of the writings through her connection through the astral. And she was able to read through the astral and document a lot of the knowledge in the book. The stanzas of Zahn, were they like, is it a specific book that can be referenced and you can pull from, or was that something that she maybe received through the astral? And how did HPB see people in the movement to use the secret doctrine? Was it more as like a reference book and, you know, to access it that way? I know it's a kind of a lot of points or ideas, but thank you.
These are very good questions, and we wish we could do them justice the time we have, but we'll try to address the main points. So it is clear, and many people acknowledge, that HPB was not a scholar, and she only had a few books on her bookshelf, and yet she was able to reference and quote information from books in obscure libraries all over the world. She even, as some scientists point out, had more knowledge of a subject than those scientists did, and had access to information about the subject that she would not know unless she was an expert in that area. And she did not know. As a matter of fact, when she first came to this country in 1873, she barely spoke English. And yet, in a few years, if we read through Isis Unveiled, we can see the development of and the power of the expression of the English language and its ability to express these universal ideas, and even more in the secret doctrine. So it is clear that she had certain innate and developed abilities to look into those realms of nature where are recorded not only the ideas, but the actual works of human endeavor. When we write or speak or do something on the physical plane, it is echoed and has its recording on the inner planes. So yes, we can listen to music. We can listen to music at a concert, and yet it can play over and over in our minds and be recorded in our memory for years and for the rest of our lives. So we know that there is an inner recording that we can access, but how much more so for those that can look into the heart of nature. But she also had the ability through her psychic nature to actually see the recorded documents and where these different references were, and to read them directly through the astral. There's a lot more that could be said about that, but that's the idea. That it, but she was also helped in this by the adepts.
Right. Yeah, she did have help. There were several writers and collators and correcting proofs and whatnot. I mean, the Secret Doctrine in Isis is well over 2,000 pages, handwritten, no typewriter. It was invented, but she, it was kind of a new invention back then, but she didn't even use it. Apparently wrote up to 16 hours a day at her table. So it's, and it's only a portion. That's the amazing part. And it's written, especially, well, Isis can kind of be read straight through, but the Secret Doctrine needs to be approached differently. You can use the index to go from subject to subject because it does skip around. And that frustrates a lot of people. It's over their heads and it skips around. And then she comes back. But it's done to awaken one's intuition. And so the Book of Zan means meditation. So it's meditative as well. It's reading it is like meditating in a sense, like SL, did you?
So here's how she told us. She wrote a book, she wrote an article, we should say, on this, how serious students should approach. And she suggested that first we make an index. What is an index? It's a list of words that we feel are very important. And as you go through, and it doesn't matter where you start, but there are going to be certain words that seem to be important or you don't know, and you write down those words and the page on which you read those words and the idea. And as you go through and you read, you expand your index about each one of those words. So if you want to know something about law, or if you want to know something about desire, or you want to know something about intuition, you have before you your index, and it's your own reference. The other thing you can do is you go through, you make note of what you know, which makes sense, that you can see, which is obvious to you when you read it. And you make note of which you don't know, which is still a mystery, which you don't understand. But you make a distinction between that which is known and that which is known. As you go through, there'll be certain ideas that are really important, passages that have great meaning to you, that are personally moving. You make note of that. And there's other things that is a mystery. And as the time goes by, you see how that mystery over time becomes less and less, and your body of knowledge becomes more and more. So what is the Secret Doctrine? It's a personal book. We each have to write our own secret doctrine as we go through it. And we could start anywhere, but take those two ideas. Develop an index and develop a record of, as you're going through, what you know and understand and appreciate, and that which still seems to be a mystery and you want to investigate more.
We have 1 minute. Go ahead.
Yeah, two interesting things we've read as regards reading the Secret Doctrine. One thing from Edgar Cayce, he was asked the question, is that Secret Doctrine like a true book or something? And his only answer to that was, the Secret Doctrine is a book that should be read in private. That's an interesting answer. And we also recall reading that HPB said, not one in 10,000 people can teach a class on the book, The Secret Doctrine. So right there it says, yep, you're gonna have to take it and
move on to yourself. Well, yeah, a lot of scientists and scholars have studied and are studying and are plumbing the depths. Sal, did you want any final remarks here?
Yes. Like anything else, it is a book that we should clear all the distractions from, read it in quiet, read it in silence, but that's not enough. It says in the Voices of Silence, we need to take forth this knowledge and pour it into another bed. In other words, after having read it and assimilated it, begin to share and discuss the ideas with others. And of course, this kind of association is the best way to do that, but we'll find opportunities in our everyday life as our vocabulary of the world thought increases. And we know how to talk to other people with different backgrounds than ourselves.
Our meeting is adjourned. Thank you all.
Thank you.